Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. You can also join us at our social media, pyvil.net. Today, we're going to start something new, and that would be Hermann Goering's Germany Reborn from 1934. I've got a PDF of it. It's shorter than 100 pages, and it's Hermann Goering explaining Germany and its history and what's going on to the English-speaking peoples, as he will say. Let's dig in. Hermann Goering, Germany Reborn. General or General Hermann Goering, Prime Minister of Prussia, Germany Reborn. Picture of Reichsmarschall Hermann Wilhelm Goering. First edition, March 1934. Reprinted March 1934, so a year after they're taken power. OCR edition, Lenculus, Exegi Monumentum Ere Perennius, in Latin, March 2018. So somebody did an OCR and then edited it. And the ISBN number is 978-0-244-68247-7. ISBN. Contents, 17 sections. We're going to do five today. And also the forward introduction, then Germany's heritage, the war, the rebellion, Versailles, and Weimar. And we'll record this whole thing in three sessions, and those are the ones we'll do in today, the first session. So let's get to it. Forward. I welcome this opportunity of presenting to the English-speaking peoples a few of my ideas about the struggle of the German people for freedom and honor. I hope that these words will also be accepted by our opponents as a frank expression of my boundless love for my country, to whose service alone I have pledged my whole life. Signed, Hermann Goering, Berlin, February 1934. Introduction. At the time Third Reich German Nazi leader Hermann Goering wrote the following manuscript, he was still a general. Later, Hermann Goering became a Reichsmarschall. In World War I, Hermann Goering took over command of von Richthofen's squadron after the Red Baron was shot down. Von Richthofen was the Red Baron. Soon after the war, Hermann Goering became a follower of Adolf Hitler. After the failed putsch, he fled to Sweden and got married. For a while, he stayed in Italy, but the ruling fascists had little to gain from helping the then-banned NSDAP. But when Hitler was released from Spandau prison, Hermann Goering was soon at his side again. Hermann Goering was intensely involved in the political fraction negotiations. Late in the Weimar Republic, Hermann Goering even became president of the Reichstag. I guess he meant political faction. After the NSDAP took power, Hermann Goering became Minister President of Prussia. Hermann Goering's reorganization of the Prussian police is described in the manuscript on this page. Already a top Nazi leader, Hermann Goering became a top-level Third Reich leader as well, both in politics and as head of the new and rapidly expanding Luftwaffe, which eventually even had its own tank formation, the Hermann Goering Panzer Division. When Hermann Goering remarried, his first wife had died, the wedding was one of the biggest social events in the Third Reich. When the Second World War broke out, Germany had the best, but not the largest, air force in the world. It lost this lead during the war, but near the end regained it with the ME-262 jet. Many experts believe Germany might have won the war if it could have held out another 6 months, i.e. enough time to build enough jets to turn the tide in the air. Hermann Goering had received a very painful wound in the groin. This medication eventually led to a drug addiction, which in turn had a negative effect on his work. Hermann Goering liked to be generous to his friends, for which he has been criticized. Despite Hermann Goering's shortcomings, Hitler remained loyal to his friend and comrade until very late in the war, when Hermann Goering attempted to negotiate peace with the West without Hitler's permission. At Nuremberg, Field Marshal Hermann Goering put up a spirited fight. In the end, Hermann Goering defied the enemy's desire to hang him by claiming suicide. and that I assume is written by whoever put together the OCR. Beginning the formal text now. One, Germany's heritage. We're going to do 1 through 5. Germany's heritage. The lack of understanding and sympathy which many foreign peoples show for Germany is very largely due to ignorance of the special and peculiar character of German history. Quoting, human history is the history of war, and the history of the German people is also a long tale of cruel wars. From the battle against Ariovistus to the struggle of the unarmed on the Ruhr and iron chain stretches, quoting Stegemann. Since the idea of Germany and a German people has been known in history, we see that the bond which it implies has only been the bond of blood and common culture and a common language. Now and then, the loose conglomerate has seemed to take on a firmer form, but right down to modern times, it has never coalesced to form a German nation. This is one of the reasons why the German people as a whole has never taken part in great wars of conquest. Usually, the different parts of Germany have fought against each other, very often to the advantage of other peoples. But for centuries, the Germans were compelled to defend their own homes and their own land, the land first of their tribe, and finally of the people. Germany possesses no natural boundaries. It was never a castle whose fortifications were sea and mountains, but lay like an open camp in the middle of Europe, protected only by the bodies of its men. And that is also the reason why the Germans never fought their wars for foreign crowns, but always for their own honor. Not to conquer foreign countries, but to defend their own freedom. Not to subdue others, but to ensure their own security. The arduous path of the German people through their history begins with the partition of the German Empire by the Treaty of Verdun in the year 843 and leads past the Testament of Richelieu and the Peace of Westphalia, which claimed to have assured forever the Libertés Germaniques, to the Dictate of Versailles in the year 1919. So Germans often at war to protect their borderless country, all the way from the Treaty of Verdun in 843 to the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, ending the 30 Years' War, up to the Versailles Peace after World War I. These German freedoms meant nothing less than the perpetual partition of the Reich into countless little kingdoms and principalities, which were played off against one another by the neighboring countries, according to Louis XI's principle, divide and conquer. And then at last, Prussia took over its great mission in world history. That was to fight for the unity of the German Reich. That was a task formidable enough for that incomparable genius, Frederick II. Even his enemies called him the Great. He was at once the most kingly of men and the most human of kings. In a life of unexampled austerity, he made of little Prussia the foundation of the coming Reich. As he lay on the simple camp bed that had seen so many campaigns, and alone in the arms of his hussar breathed his last breath, his last words remained as a testament to his successors. I see the promised land from afar, but I shall not set foot in it. After Frederick the Great came from the Reichsfreiherr von Stein, who fought passionately for his great ideal. I know only one fatherland, and that is called Germany. But he too, after a valiant life of work and battles and defeats, the victim of slander and treachery, could only win a partial victory. He too knew of the coming unity, but was not to experience it. After Stein, Bismarck. Born on an estate in the Mark Brandenburg, he continued and almost completed the gigantic task begun by Frederick and Stein. But Bismarck, at the moment of death, as if death itself had torn a veil from his eyes, cried, full of sorrow and misgiving, these last words, Germany, Germany. Under the flags in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, in which Bismarck's Reich was born, stood Lieutenant von Hindenburg. He had fought in the battlefield of Königgrätz and in the war against France. In the greatest of all wars, his imperial master called him to the head of the mighty army, which for 4 years withstood a hostile world. Somewhere in this vast bulwark of German men, there stood one who, unknown like the countless others, and brave as so many others were brave, was destined to write his name in the eternal book of history as the savior of the German people, the man who was to consummate her solidarity and unity. That man was Adolf Hitler. In the three great wars won by Prussia in the last century, Germany was born. On the battlefields of Leipzig and Waterloo, of Königgrätz and Sedan, men of German blood found each other again. Before the guns of Paris and in the palace of Louis XIV, the age-old German dream of a German empire was fulfilled. Through the concentration of all national forces, an unprecedented advance took place. A peace of nearly 50 years under the protection of a strong army and a good fleet enabled the young Reich brilliantly to build up its industry and ensure prosperity. Whereas the population of Germany in 1871 was 41 millions, in 1914, it had risen to nearly 70 millions. Again, you got the Industrial Revolution in Germany really gaining strength. And Britain becoming fearful as it is being surpassed economically by Germany and resolving to destroy it. A vast host of human beings was pressing onward, was working in fields and factories, in laboratories and mines, behind counters and desks, or in harbors and wharves all over the world. This great success is known to the world and can be statistically demonstrated. Germany was first in the markets of the world as regards electrical apparatus, the glass and toy industry, and smelting and mining. The German chemical industry alone supplied 4/5 of the world market. German trade with harbors outside Europe had increased 500% up to the beginning of the century. Thus, Germany, in peaceful competition, by hard work, efficiency, and organization, had grown to be a mighty factor in the economic life of the world. This position, won through peaceful work, led finally to the most terrible of all conflicts, the World War. The encirclement of Germany was complete, and the peoples of Europe plunged into a sea of blood and misery, and the whole world into a catastrophe of incalculable extent. Again, he's writing this 18 years after the war. On the 28th June 1914, a 19-year-old student in Sarajevo shot the Austrian heir apparent. This shot suddenly and pitilessly let loose the thunderstorm which had been brooding over Europe for years. The first rumblings were produced by the never-ending railway trains which brought the already mobilized Russian Army Corps to the German frontier. The gigantic engine of war began its deadly pounding. Europe was mobilizing. The die had been cast. Threatened from all sides, Germany had the sword thrust into her hand. The German people, guiltless of the outbreak of this greatest of wars, had to fight in order to defend their life and honor. Chapter 2. The War. The most precious possession that a people can have, its freedom and honor, was threatened. And the German people did its duty. The German army, in order that it should not itself be overthrown and destroyed, marched through Belgium. It was self-defense in the highest sense of the word. It is true that the peoples of the different countries, whether of Germany or of England, of France or Russia, felt themselves to be guiltless. They obeyed their governments and did their duty. The German people, too, from emperor to peasant, from field marshal to private, were deeply convinced of their own innocence and believed unflinchingly in the justice of their cause. For 4 long years, the German soldier fought heroically and chivalrously. The army and the people suffered grievously from the terrible enemy propaganda concerning so-called atrocities. It may be that our enemies honestly believed that it was necessary to use such propaganda in order to alienate the sympathies of the world from the brave German people. It may be that they really believed that faked evidence and faked photos were necessary to this end. Germany knew that all this was simply calumny. To be sure, war is hard. the fate of the individual becomes insignificant over against the fate of whole nations, but it was never the German way to torment and discredit their enemies. Love of cruelty was never part of the Germanic character. Many a French or Belgian child who had lost a hand or arm or leg, which, according to the photos, had been hacked off by the Germans, could now reveal that these mutilations were caused by the shells or bombs of their own countrymen. Such things are unavoidable in war. I myself fought in the Western Front from the first day of the war to the last, and can state on my word of honor that the German soldiers always endeavored to ease the hard lot of the civil population. Never has any people in the history of the world had to hold its own in such a mighty struggle as the German people were compelled to do during these years. No epic could describe what heroism, what patient endurance, what devotion to duty were shown on all fronts. For 4 years, the German army held at bay a world of enemies, vastly superior in numbers and war material, and defended their country from invasion. For 4 years, the German people endured and suffered grievously, as in a besieged city. Every man who was capable of bearing arms, old men and boys, went out to join in the deadly struggle. And at home, German women, by their patient endurance and forgetfulness of self, proved the greatness and nobility, their greatness and nobility. In spite of all the enemy's efforts, Germany seemed unconquerable. But at last came the bitter end, the terrible defeat. After long years during which the blood of the best men had been spilt, after long years of hunger and attrition, a party consisting of traitors to their country succeeded in confusing the people at home and in poisoning its soul. Supported by enemy propaganda, bribed with the enemy's money, social democrat agitators stirred up the people. Germany, bleeding from 1,000 wounds, starving and exhausted, heroically carried on the fight against the enemies from without, but she was no longer strong enough to withstand the enemy within. The people was stirred up against its leaders with the slogan, "For the freedom of your class! For the freedom of the individual!" Strikes and munitions works were organized by social democrat leaders, and the same leaders drew up appeals to commit treachery or to desert. And so at last the fate of the army, which was still fighting bravely, was sealed. This bravest of all armies had its backbone broken from behind. What the enemy would have never been able to do in open battle, they achieved through their alliance with the German Social Democrats. But, in spite of all, the troops unconquered carried back their unspotted shield of honor and their victorious banners. The mightiest struggle of history was at an end, World War I. Germany had lost the war and her freedom, but her enemies were only in appearance the victors. The countries of the West were on the verge of collapse, and Europe threatened to disappear in chaos. Chapter 3, The Rebellion. With the disastrous end of the war, the German people began its time of trial. With the introduction of pernicious doctrines of the Jew Karl Marx into Germany, began the attack on the strength of the Reich and the attempt to undermine the peace and well-being of the people. The basis of Marxism is class war, and the destruction of national unity is its point of departure. German is set against German. The enemy is no longer the adversary beyond the frontier, but only those fellow countrymen within who belong to a different social stratum. If Marxism was to succeed, a strong and contented Germany had to be made weak and discontented. And so, for many decades, Marxists were working systematically with this end in view. Everywhere, hatred, envy, discontent, and suspicion were being preached, and the stability of the Reich was being undermined. Now, the army and the navy have always symbolized the strength of a people. It was therefore against the armed forces of the state that Marxism directed its passionate hatred. And so, wherever it could, the Social Democratic Party injured the prestige of the army, refused to vote for supplies, and undermined discipline. For decades, this party carried on an agitation against all authority, undermined existing institutions by every means, in order finally, with one last stab in the back, the Dolchstoßlegende, to overthrow the state itself. It was a matter of indifference to this party that Germany herself, by losing the war, would be given over to destruction. And so, on the 9th November 1918, that vile rising of mutineers took place, and Marxist dominance was established. 9th November, 1918. On the same day there began for the poor, tormented German people that period of history that may be described as the period of German shame and tribulation. From the steps of the Reichstag, Scheidemann, a prominent leader of the Social Democrats, proclaimed, quote, "Today the German people are victorious all along the line," unquote. And at that very moment, the German people plunged from proud heights into the abyss. It was not the people which was victorious on that day, for all the best elements of the people still stood on all fronts, ready to give their last drop of blood in defense of their country. Only those traitors were victorious, for whom the very idea of a fatherland was non-existent. Those cowards who had deserted from the front were victorious, that human scum that always makes its appearance in times of stress. It was Marxism that was victorious. But wherever Marxism is victorious, at that same moment a nation collapses. Where communism raises its head, a people is destroyed. The returning soldiers, without leaders, uprooted from their civil occupations, estranged from their homes, disappointed and even desperate, fell an easy prey to Marxist agitation. Social democracy increased enormously, took over the leadership everywhere, and from that time on became responsible for Germany's destiny. An unspeakable hatred was preached against everything which did not conform to Marxist doctrine. The brilliant past was trod in the dust, and scorn and ridicule were heaped on everything which the people still held sacred. Morality was banished, and immorality was declared moral. The very idea of patriotism was denounced, and national parties were destroyed. For the strength and power which lies in national unity was to be substituted international solidarity. The class-conscious proletarian was to take the place of the patriotic German. Germany broke up into two camps. On the one side, the proletariat. On the other, the bourgeoisie. The whole German people had to atone terribly for this crime of class war. But in accusing social democracy of this crime of treason towards the people, one must not forget that it was made possible only because the middle classes altogether failed to act. The middle class had, even before the war, degenerated to become the bourgeoisie. The complete bankruptcy of middle class leadership before the war, the lack of understanding on the part of the middle classes for the German worker, their snobbery and self-conceit, made it possible that the leaderless German worker should prove all too susceptible to the seductions of Marxism and should lend a ready ear to the demagogues who were mostly of an alien race and who claimed to represent the interests of the working class. If one looks back at the time before the war, one is amazed to see how weak the leaders of the nation really were and with what apathy they looked on while the people were being duped. But one will also be amazed to see what a high percentage of the social democratic leaders and agitators were Jews. But now in the days of the post-war rising, these Jewish leaders sprouted from the ground like poisonous fungi. Wherever soldiers' councils were formed, Jews were the leaders, those very same Jews who had not been seen out at the front, but had been employed in the supply departments at the base, or had filled indispensable official and military posts at home, the rear echelon motherfuckers or Remfs. In the streets, the mob raged. Soldiers had their badges and shoulder straps torn off. The flag, which for decades had symbolized the greatness of the Reich, was trampled in the mud. On all buildings fluttered the red flag of rebellion. Everywhere there was disorder and dissolution, the communist flag. Communist rebellion, he's talking about the end of World War I. This disorder was deliberately displayed in the way people deported themselves to make it quite clear that now everyone could do or not do what he liked. There was to be no state, no order, no authority, and the moral conception of freedom was to be rejected in favor of immoral shamelessness. The misled soldiers began slowly to sink to the level of a mere rabble. Dissolution grew daily, even hourly. Radicals had their places taken by even more extreme radicals. and gradually it seemed as if the new rulers, who had set themselves at the head of the nation with such high-sounding proclamations, would themselves be drawn into the whirlpool of destruction. They could no longer get rid of the spirits they had invoked. The independent Social Democrats pressed forward, and then these too were overtaken and were succeeded by the Spartacists. The Spartacists were still around when I was in Germany in 87. A lot of posters that copied the German Communist Party. In this chaos, which the new leaders could do nothing to overcome, there was only one way out. An appeal was made to the remnants of the army, once so powerful, but now so weak. In the midst of the general dissolution, a few thousand who were not willing timidly to abandon everything had come together in order to withstand the general collapse and to defend their ideals of patriotism and honor. These were the Volunteer Corps, the Freikorps, and to them the new government appealed. They were cleverly able to befool the Volunteer Corps into believing that they would have to come forward to save their country, by which the leaders of the government really meant their own power and safety. Save the country, they meant save themselves. The unpolitical soldiers of the Volunteer Corps did not understand the true state of things. They were accustomed always to intervene where their country was in danger, and so once more, without thinking of themselves, they did their duty. They staked their lives and threw themselves into the battle against the Spartacist rabble. But hardly had they won and become masters of the situation, and hardly did the government feel itself safe in the saddle when it showed its true face and rewarded the Volunteer Corps by dissolving them and throwing them onto the streets. But to the world, the German Social Democrats suddenly proclaimed themselves to be the maintainers of order, the guardians of the Reich. Even today, one still frequently hears the objection that the Social Democrats did at any rate in 1918 and 1919 save the Reich by courageously restoring order. Ebert, Scheidemann, and Noske are said to have saved the Reich from dissolution. With the Social Democrats, we are accustomed to such distortions of fact and such attempts to divest themselves of responsibility. The delegates of the people had announced in high-sounding proclamations that the age of freedom had dawned, that the worker was now ruler in the land, and that he would have little work and large earnings, that the age of peace and universal prosperity was at hand, that the other nations would joyfully welcome a Germany freed from militarism and monarchic tyranny, that poverty and want would cease, that corruption would be abolished, in short, that the Golden Age was about to begin. But they forgot that before this famous proclamation, the German people did not even know what corruption meant. It was left to the Social Democrats to introduce corruption as one of the most essential phenomena of their rule. The end of the proclamation was that Germany was now to become a land of freedom, beauty, and honor. None of these promises, not one of them, was kept. On the contrary, one can show today conclusively that the exact opposite took place, he says from the vantage of 1934, talking about 1919. Chapter 4, Versailles. The dream was abruptly dispelled, and so was the hope of eternal peace, of future happiness, and of the prosperity of all peoples. Suddenly, into the midst of this joyful music of the future, into the midst of this drivel about humanity, there sounded sharply and discordantly the trumpets of Versailles. For the first time, Germany awoke from the intoxication of civil strife. In a flash, it was seen that Germany had again been deceived. Trusting in Wilson's words and in his 14 points, the sword had been laid aside. Germany had trustfully abandoned herself to the assurances concerning the universal happiness of peoples and international solidarity. And now she saw herself defenseless against a world bristling with armaments and hatred. Germanium esse delendam was the slogan of Versailles. Germans must be destroyed. More devilish than the mind of a Dante could have imagined were the peace terms of Versailles. Never has any people in the history of the world been presented with such terms. Even the destruction of Carthage was as nothing compared to the shameful peace of Versailles. The word peace seemed shamed and desecrated forever. a brave people, peaceful and hardworking, loving freedom and honor, was now confined in the prison house of Versailles. The thirst for revenge was now satisfied by the destruction of the once feared, but also respected, enemy. In their blind hatred, the enemies of Germany did not see that, with this so-called peace, they were leading not only Germany, but the whole world, to catastrophe. But in Germany, the Marxist angels of peace continued, in spite of everything, to prate before the people of international solidarity. The blame for the dictate of Versailles was put down to having lost the war, but it was forgotten that the Social Democrats themselves had made the collapse of the German people possible through their treacherous action. Again, the stab in the back. But the German people realized too late that it had in the past months thrown away its honor, and that now, without honor, it was deprived of its freedom as well. Only once did it rise again as one man when the shame became unbearable. The German generals were to be delivered up. What Englishman, what Frenchman would not blush with shame if such a suggestion were made to his people? We Germans know today that our enemies would never have made such humiliating demands if they had not seen Germany's moral collapse before them. Only because they had seen how the German leaders at that time were destroying every idea of honor and national pride could they inflict such humiliations on Germany. 5, and last for today. Chapter 5, Weimar. The Marxist Democratic National Assembly of Weimar, Marxist Democratic is hyphenated, National Assembly of Weimar, was nevertheless not ashamed to make the Versailles Treaty the foundation of the new German constitution. The Weimar state was born of treachery and cowardice. Its cornerstones were misery and shame. The new Germany, however, received the full blessings of this democracy in the form of uncontrolled parliamentarianism. All ideas were turned upside down. The distinguishing mark of parliamentarianism, in contrast to the principle of leadership, is that authority is given from below upwards and responsibility from above downwards. That is to say, innumerable parties and their delegates impose their authority on the government, and the government has to obey them. The government is therefore responsible to these parties and is the plaything of their interests. But the laws of nature demand that authority should be exercised from above downwards and responsibility from below upwards. Each leader has authority and he issues his orders to his officials and followers below him, but he is responsible only to his superiors. And the leader at the top is responsible to the people as a whole and to their future. In the past, it has only been by virtue of this principle that anything has been achieved. Only by this principle could nations arise and history be made. But in Germany, Parliament now ruled, the anonymous idea of the majority ruled, the cowardice of mere members was the dominant factor. In the midst of these divisions of class and party, countless groups sought their own advantage at the expense of the people. Marxism celebrated its greatest triumphs. The princes had been driven away, and the Red Masters climbed into the vacant thrones, but did not on that account become rulers. Above them all, the golden calf was enthroned, and the parties continued their grotesque dance. In every walk of life, we see decadence and decay. The breakup of the nation grows yearly more apparent, and the Reich is, from now on, a shadow, a framework held together with difficulty, already brittle in many places and without any sense or purpose. Corruption, immorality, and indecency were the outward signs of the proud republic. And the decline of culture begins with the loosening of morals. Jews believe that too. See the Frankfurt School. And their focus on sexual immorality is the way to destroy the white race. And then came the terrible inflation. Since the attempt had been made, in proper Marxist fashion, to destroy all cultural, ideal, and moral values, it was only logical that this campaign of destruction should now be directed against the economic life of the nation. Marxism can thrive only where there are people who are discontented, homeless, uprooted from the soil, and therefore receptive to false doctrines. The attempt was made to create in every social stratum a proletariat. The German was to be made, morally and materially, a proletarian. Thus, the inflation destroyed any prosperity that still remained. Wherever there was inherited property, it was destroyed. Thousands were plunged into poverty overnight. The last remnants of property were destroyed by the inflation and by a purely Bolshevist system of taxation. One has only to think of that witch's Sabbath of soaring millions. Was this the economic program of Marxism? Was this what they meant by complete socialization? Later, they modestly called the inflation a natural phenomenon and forgot that it was only the result of their criminal doctrines. Here again, we see the close connection which ultimately exists between Marxism and liberalism. How could the bourgeoisie be surprised when the poorest sections of the population now suddenly applied to the economic sphere the ideas of equality, freedom, and fraternity preached in the name of liberalism? One could see at once how the boundaries between social democracy and the middle class parties became ever less distinct. The social democrat leaders became more and more bourgeois and sought to defend and keep what they had gained for their own personal profit. Their slogan was no longer "to the barricades." They were suddenly for law and order. On the other hand, the middle class parties contributed to the general collapse by their lack of character. Think of the Republican Party in the U.S. in 2020, 100 years after he's writing this. Today we accuse social democracy, whether as at the beginning in its red Jacobite hat, the Jacobins in the French Revolution, or as later in top hat, and it is the capitalist stereotype, of having cheated and robbed Germany. But we must not forget that the bourgeois parties, and above all the eternally vacillating center party, participated in this wherever it occurs. So that the center party is the Catholic Party. She's saying the middle classes were morally weak and cowardly and didn't do anything to resist the rise of the social democrats and the Marxists. In spite of all philosophical differences between the black and the red parties, black would be reaction or conservatism, red would be the communist, the black never left the red in the lurch. Conservatives always end up siding with the communists and the liberals in the end because they're weak. Parties ruled, unrestrained and unchecked, through parliament, but weary and heavy laden, the people had to bear their cross of suffering. Together with this inner dissolution, Germany's prestige abroad suffered more and more, all love of country having been proscribed and all manly virtues derided. It was only logical that the German government should be condemned to complete impotence in its foreign policy. Germany had become the whipping boy of international politics. Conflicting interests between the other powers were settled at Germany's expense. The League of Nations seemed to be exclusively an instrument to keep Germany down and to protect the Treaty of Versailles. In accordance with the terms of that treaty, Germany had completely disarmed and had thus become completely defenseless. With a zeal which was worthy of a nobler cause, the German governments had supervised and carried out this disarmament. But they went even further than the Treaty of Versailles required. They disarmed the German people morally and spiritually as well. They killed all will to live and to resist. In the insane desire for fulfillment of all the provisions of the treaty, they became intoxicated with astronomical figures. Since they had robbed the people of their honor, they were dishonorable themselves towards friends and foe. In place of a straightforward, honest, dignified policy which would be practicable even in times of the greatest disaster, they carried out a policy of trickery. They tried to get round the most difficult problems of foreign policy by appealing to international solidarity. It was altogether characteristic of German parliamentary policy not to solve problems, but to escape from every vital question by means of some cowardly compromise. And then came communism. It developed inevitably from the false doctrines of Marxism. Communism raised its head as an inevitable result of a policy of cowardice and self-surrender, and encouraged by a policy alternating between Marxist trickery and middle-class cowardice, it was inevitably victorious. At the birth of the Republic, there were only a few thousand followers of communism, but after a few years, the number had risen to 6 million, and communism was prepared to seize power and to destroy culture, morals, the church, and industry. It was ready to plunge Germany into chaos. Poverty and despair had seized the German people and driven them and their thousands into the arms of communism. Millions of men, filled with hatred, wished to destroy because everything in them had been destroyed, and there were leaders ready for these desperate, deluded people. These leaders came from the underworld and were the scum of the population. And here, too, the Jew was more strongly represented than elsewhere. With the subman, hyphenated, with the subman's will to destroy, he felt that his time had come, did the Jew. The flag was hoisted, blood red it fluttered, with the star of the Soviets in the middle. If this symbol should conquer, then Germany must go under in a rising flood of Bolshevism. And that's where we'll end it today, the end of Chapter 5, Weimar. I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Hermann Göring's Germany Reborn. We did chapters 1 to 5, and you can find this as part of our Learning College at vnnforum.com, recorded for all time. Thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again for more from Hermann Göring real soon.